Impact of Influence, The Murdoch Family Murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth.
Hello, friend. So great for you to spend time with us. I am Matt Harris. Seton Tucker is here, too. It's Impact of Influence on Facebook. Got a great interview coming up in just a moment. We'd love for you to reach out, as I said, on Impact of Influence. We're a part of the Evergreen podcast team right now. And we've got a YouTube channel that we're starting. This one won't be up on the YouTube channel, but just want to, I guess, warn you that you'll be able to see upcoming episodes on our YouTube channel, Impact of Influence. You can go there now if you can find us and check previous episodes out. We started doing Impact of Influence just a couple of weeks after the murders of Maggie and Paul Murdoch. And it was all things Murdoch until we ventured out a little bit and did some other episodes about crimes that happened in the South. One of those was about Pee Wee Gaskins. And coming up soon, we will re-release the Pee Wee Gaskins episode. Pee Wee Gaskins was probably the most notorious serial killer in South Carolina history. He stabbed, shot, drowned, and poisoned more than a dozen people between 1970 and 1975. He was a career criminal his whole life. And they found him because they were searching for this missing girl. They started looking for her, and then they discovered eight bodies buried in shallow graves near Pee Wee's home in Prospect, South Carolina. And in 1976 in Florence County, the jury found him guilty for the murder of one of the eight victims, sentenced him to death by the electric chair, but that was overturned by the South Carolina Supreme Court. And in February of 78 or thereabouts, rather than face a new trial, Pee Wee pled guilty to nine murders, and he was given 10 concurrent life sentences to be served at Central Correctional Institution, CCI prison in Columbia, South Carolina. And you're going to hear more about that prison in a few minutes with our interview guest. Well, while at that prison, Gaskins murdered Rudolph Tyner, who was a fellow inmate on death row. He used C4 explosives. You can hear more about that in the episode. And then he received his second death sentence, which was administered in September of 1991. That's when the finale to Pee Wee Gaskins' life happened. He also wrote a book in there right before he was put to death row called The Autobiography of a Serial Killer, Final Truth. And he claimed in that book that he killed 110 people, but with very few exceptions, that's been discredited by law enforcement and journalists, and says he was just trying to gain notoriety, pumped up the number. And the book is really graphic and really nasty. It's even hard to find right now, as a matter of fact. But it's going to be great because we get to talk to the attorney who defended Pee Wee Gaskins in that final death row case. Now we are joined by Jack Swerling, who practices law in Columbia, South Carolina. Got his Bachelor of Arts degree from Clemson and his law degree from the University of South Carolina School of Law. He was a member of the Supreme Court of South Carolina's Board of Law Examiners and a member of the Supreme Court's Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline. He is currently a member of the Chief Justice's Commission on the Profession. He has been on the faculty of the University of South Carolina School of Medicine, Department of Neuropsychiatry, for more than 20 years, and formerly served in the faculty of the University of South Carolina School of Law for a number of years. He's the author of the South Carolina Criminal Trial Notebook, My Little Rules Book, Criminal, and a contributor to the South Carolina Criminal Trial Techniques Handbook, as well as a number of articles. He's listed in the Bar Register of Preeminent Lawyers, Best Lawyers in America, as well as Super Lawyers in South Carolina. Jack, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I wanted to start off, I just read that you're a graduate of Clemson and that you went to Clemson with the intent of being a veterinarian. How did you end up becoming a lawyer?
Well, I got sidetracked after three semesters of chemistry. And that was, it was obviously not going to work because you have to have chemistry every year you're in vet school. So I switched over to political science and economics, and I worked in Manhattan right after Clemson for Liberty Mutual as a court adjuster. I worked in the Manhattan civil courts and got really fascinated by trial work and decided that, well, let me try this thing. And so I came back down to the University of South Carolina Law School and in 1970 and got my degree in 73.
So you settled into being a defense attorney. Was there something in your background or maybe growing up that guided you in that direction?
Well, I grew up in a, you know, pretty tough area, Newark, New Jersey. And, you know, I always liked working for the underdog. I was always around, you know, there was an underdog and helping underdogs. And so I guess criminal work became an obvious, thing to go for because now I'm representing a lot of underdogs. I think it just gravitated to that. I did a little bit of everything my first few years, but I found that the criminal law was fascinating. Representing people who really needed a lawyer.
It was really interesting because we started our podcast covering the Murdoch saga, and we did a kind of a throwback episode on Pee Wee Gaskins, and Dick Harpootlian was the one who prosecuted him, and you represented Pee Wee Gaskins at one point. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, Dick and I had gone to Clemson together. We knew each other from our Clemson days. And then we kind of met again in law school, and he became a prosecutor and I became a defense lawyer and, you know, very close friends. And in 1983, Gaskins, I think it was 83, Gaskins got arrested for the murder in the Department of Corrections at what we call CCI. And I was the one that drew the lucky short straw and got appointed to represent Pee Wee, and Dick was the prosecutor. He was a deputy solicitor at that time. So we reunited. Now, we had tried a couple cases against each other before that, but that was really the big case.
What was your first meeting with Pee Wee Gaskins like?
Well, you know, I had an image of Pee Wee from, you know, the newspapers and all the publicity about when he went through those trials in the 70s, and so I really didn't know what to expect, and I went down there to maximum security to meet him, and he was on a starvation diet at that point. So this little guy who probably didn't weigh, you know, but 120 pounds, he was in the cell. He couldn't even move because he was starving himself to death. And so it was quite a shock to me to see him like that, and then also to realize that he had been accused of some 12 or 13 murders. So it was an eye-opener for me to see him like that. And, you know, we spoke. He was able to go ahead and communicate to some extent. But, you know, here I was in this small little cell with this guy who had killed so many people. And he was just this, you know, guy who just looked, he was probably under 100 pounds at that point.
Jeez.
I mean, we got along. I pretty much learned everything about Pee Wee Gaskins that you could know in that first meeting, because he really just had a very narrow background. He was in reform school. He was in prison before. I mean, he probably had not been out of prison, but maybe his whole life at that point, maybe 20 years. So, you know, it was fascinating for me. I mean, I grew up with, you know, some pretty tough characters, and Pee Wee was, of course, notorious.
Yeah.
And so I just didn't know what to expect, but it was an unusual meeting, and we happened to get along.
Were you ever concerned for your safety?
Not with him, because he was the kind of individual who, he appreciated me being there, and he appreciated the fact that I was going to be representing him. The only time I ever had any fear when I was going over to death row, and you had to walk through this tunnel. There were very, very few guards around when you walked through the tunnel. The inmates walked around through the tunnel. And then when I went into cell block 2, which is where death row was, some of those folks were just out of control. And, you know, they yelled and they screamed and they banged on the, you know, the bars and someone threw urine at people. They were just, you know, you're talking about the you know, the toughest of the tough or the most dangerous of the dangerous that were in cell block two. Cell block two had been the stables for Sherman during Civil War.
Oh, wow.
And it was this old building. And when you went in there, I mean, you know, everybody was locked down, but they were just really just out of control. A lot of them periodically throughout the day. So people were screaming and yelling all the time. And Pee Wee later was moved over there. But most of the witnesses I had to interview, I actually interviewed every person on death row.
What?
And so that was, you know, kind of a little scary for me.
We should point out he's 6'4", by the way.
Yeah, because you're 6'4", and you're interviewing this person who's less than 100 pounds at the time.
Well, with Pee Wee, yeah. But in Pee Wee, I never felt in danger with. But when I spent all that time in death row, I really felt like, you know, there was danger. And, you know, I was always making sure there were guards around because you never knew what to expect when you went into cell block two. It was a haunting place.
Were you interviewing the people on death row for Pee Wee's defense, or was that just through the...
Yeah. No, it was for Pee Wee's defense because they were all there when murder took place of Rudolph Tyner. I wanted to know what everybody there saw, heard, and I also wanted to know, you know, Pee Wee, amazingly enough, even though he had been under life sentences and been tried for the death penalty, and his sentences were commuted to life, he had become the building manager of cell block two. I don't know if you saw that in the story or any of your knowledge of the story, but Pee Wee was basically in charge, the inmate in charge of cell block two. And he was the, you know, the mechanic, the electrician. He had a little sandwich concession. It was just a quite unusual setup down there that Pee Wee ran the place other than his. Obviously, there were guards there, and you know, CCI had a warden. But as far as the hierarchy of prisoners, Pee Wee's at the top.
Wow. Which is interesting, because he wasn't an educated man, and he had spent the majority of his life in prison. That he, I guess maybe he was institutionalized. He knew how to play the system. Is that your thought?
He was very cunning. Very cunning. I mean, he knew how to, you know, he knew how to play the game. And I really mean it when I say cunning. And he was very street smart, street savvy. And so I think that's how he was able to go ahead and rise to that position. And nobody ever messed with Pee Wee because they knew that if they did, you know, he had a history of violence. So despite his size, his personality was pretty overbearing. And, you know, people on death row, even on death row, were afraid of him. So he ran the building with an iron fist, and nobody ever messed with him.
So when you were talking to the other people on death row in that section two, were they afraid to speak out against Pee Wee when you were saying, okay, what did you see? What did you hear? Blah, blah, blah. Were they like, I'm not telling you nothing, or were they talking?
Well, we never really got any evidence from anybody in cell block two that was against Pee Wee. But I felt like since I was handling a death penalty case, you know, that I had to go ahead and interview everybody that I could. I mean, some people just didn't want to talk. Other people, you know, had things to say about Pee Wee, but not in a necessarily negative way. They just didn't want to, you know, they didn't get involved with him. So I don't think I ever really got any material information from, you know, the people who were on death row. Interestingly enough, the guards in cell block two were very positive about Pee Wee. He listened to them. He did what they asked him to do. They never had any trouble from him. So several of them came and testified in his defense as character. And that was, I always found that to be very interesting, that they were willing to come up there and talk about the fact that he, you know, was a guy who listened to what they wanted him to do. He followed directions, and he never gave them any trouble.
I know when we spoke before, we talked about handling a death penalty case as a defense attorney. Tell us a little bit about what that is like and how you approach that differently.
You know, I mean, I've handled probably several hundred murder cases over my career. But there's nothing like a death penalty case because of the penalty that's involved. So while I normally obviously always try and dot every I and cross every T to defend somebody, there's that extra burden and pressure when you're dealing with the death penalty because of, you know, what the ultimate penalty is. In addition to that, it's a bifurcated trial. So you have a guilt or innocence phase, but then you also have the phase where the jury determines the punishment. And so what happens in that phase of the trial, you have to go back and talk to his neighbors, you have to talk to his friends, you know, talk to people that he was in school with, talk to people that he was in prison with, you know, not necessarily the inmates, but, you know, the administration. And so you're really doing a lot, you're doing a lot more work than a death penalty case because of the punishment phase of the trial, in addition to the guilt or innocence phase of the trial. So, I mean, I had, you know, if I recall correctly, well over 1,000 hours in the case.
Wow.
And I got paid $750 by the state.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Yeah. 75 cents an hour, I think it worked out to, something like that.
Peavy was making more in prison than you were.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, but that was the statutory amount that I was entitled to in those days in 1983. By statute, the maximum fee for a death penalty case was $1,500. But I was appointed along with the public defender, and they ruled that even though I was, you know, I was the only one who was going to get paid because the public defender was on the public payroll, all I was entitled to was half of the
$1,500.
Jeez. So this is true. I mean, it worked out to about 75 cents an hour.
Let's talk about one of our sponsors. It is Factor. You can eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals.
Every fresh meal is never frozen and is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, and they are ready in just 2 minutes.
Where did you have chili the other day?
Delicious.
And if you want gourmet meals, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, asparagus. So head to factormeals.com/impact50 and use code impact50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box.
That code's impact50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Impact 50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderich.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.
So how do you sign up for this? Do you, when you get appointed, did you agree to this?
No, what happens is you get on a death penalty list of people who are qualified by their background and experience. You know, I think at that time you had to have at least 5 years of felony experience. You had to have a certain number of trials. And I was what they call death penalty qualified.
Good for you. You get to get that 30, 75 cents an hour.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I was looking for that. I hung around the courthouse trying to get appointed. I was kidding. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, I guess at that point I had already tried a number of cases. So people were familiar with me. The judges were familiar with me. And so I got I won the lottery and I got to represent Pee-wee.
The Pee-wee case, was he accepting the guilt on the murder of the inmate and it was the fight over the death penalty, or what was the plea situation? And
well, he actually, I was reading some of the final argument last night, because I had to do that for something else. And he actually addressed the jury in the penalty phase closing argument.
Oh.
And he was, you know, he said, well, I may have done some of these things, but I didn't do the others. And they don't have the facts right. He denied killing Tyner. He said he didn't do it. He said he was part of the chain of circumstances, which, you know, meant that they had gotten the C4 explosives into prison. He got a hold of the C4 explosives. They made a little bomb. You know, what happened was they put the C4 explosives in a tin can. And there was an ignition on the bottom. There was a plug connected to the can. And when you put the plug into the AC socket, it blew up. And that's how they killed Tyner. But Peewee always denied that he was last in the chain and denied giving the can to Tyner. However, you know, there was some recorded conversations that he made. He actually made the recordings. When he was talking to people on the outside of the prison, and they were very incriminating. And so they really, at that point, the jury didn't find any doubt whatsoever about he was actually the person who gave Tyner the tin can and actually plugged it into an AC socket and blew up in Tyner's hand, and pretty much taken off half of his head as well.
Jeez. When I read the trial is 8 weeks, does that mean everything together combined, the guilt and innocent and the whether it's a death penalty or not?
Yeah, what happened was, also kind of an interesting background on that. The jury selection took about 4 weeks.
Wow.
They brought in somewhere around 400 people, and because Peewee was notorious.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so on the first day, Dick Harpooley and I spoke about it yesterday because we were recalling it to somebody else. But our recollection was that on the first day, we seated one juror. And it took another week and a half to get a second juror.
Wow.
And that's crazy that the Murdoch trial took 1 day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the questions were like this. Have you ever heard of Peewee Gaskins? Yes. would you give him a fair trial? You know, well, some of them equivocated. I don't know. You know, if you found him guilty, would you send him to the death chamber, to the electric chair? Yes.
Jeez.
So you had, I mean, that's the kind of answers that we were getting. I mean, people either could not be fair about guilt or innocence. And then many others, if we got past that stage, said that they would electrocute him. And so that's why it took so long going through jury selection. And we were doing individual voir dire questioning of each juror. Each one took about a half hour, 45 wow. minutes. The lawyers were actually doing the voir dire, which is not the usual way to do it. The judges usually conduct voir dire, except in death penalty cases. But we were getting answers like that. I mean, you know, do you think he ought to be electrocuted? No. Why not? Well, that's too good for him. He ought to be hung.
Oh, geez, sweet Jesus. Was there a change of venue discussion or anything?
I think early on there was. Frankly, I don't recall that. It's so many years ago. But
right.
I'm sure we discussed it in the beginning, and we were not going to get a change of venue.
No.
We may have actually even argued that. I just really don't remember because it's almost 40 years or more than 40 years ago now.
Sure.
There was this bizarre kind of kidnapping plot situation that happened with Dick Harpootlian. Can you tell us anything about that? And then reading about you, it seems like you were also had one of your former clients come and break into your home.
Yeah, I can thank Harpootlian for that too. tell you, what happened was Dick had a daughter who was at that time very young, maybe 7 or 8 years old, maybe not even that. I don't remember. Kate. And, you know, what Peewee did is he was arranging the kidnapping of Dick's daughter and was going to use her as a hostage to go ahead and have the state vacate the death penalty or commute his death penalty to life. And so they uncovered that plot that, he was going to have her kidnapped and then use her as a hostage negotiations to get him out of the death penalty.
Oh, wow.
So that's very true. And they fortunately uncovered the plot, and it never took place. What happened with me, Dick and I, after the Peewee trial, and, you know, we pretty much had coffee together every day after court, went over to a restaurant and had coffee, and you know, an appetizer. And, you know, we fought like dogs in the courtroom, but we were close friends. And so, you know, we had a social relationship. And during that period, Dick and I started talking about, you know, what are we going to do post-trial? And he decided he was going to run, he wanted to practice law. I was with Isidore Lurie, who was a powerful state senator at that time. And the discussion evolved into maybe we should go into partnership together. So a year or so after the trial, he left the solicitor's office. I left Isidore Lurie, and we formed a partnership together. Several years later, Dick decided to run for solicitor himself, which is our chief prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And he was representing this fellow named Jimmy Causey. And he said, look, I'm going to run for a solicitor. I got to stop doing defense work, you know, so I can do the campaigning and all that. And he said, would you take over several of my cases? And I said, of course. And Jimmy Causey turned out to be one of those cases that I represented. Jimmy Causey, years later, was the one that came into my house, held my wife and my daughter and I, and taped us up, robbed us, threatened to kill us. And basically they got charged with kidnapping and burglary and armed robbery. So I could thank Dick for that because I took over his case in the late 80s. So I have a lot to say about Harpootlian, but we're still very close friends.
Well, that's really scary. Was that a thought, being a criminal defense attorney, that you fear for your own and your family's safety at times?
Well, I did. There was a trial after Pee-wee, Larry Jean Bell, who was a serial killer, actually. And he was really mentally ill. And his brother and I went to law school together. And when he got arrested, he asked me to represent him, which was a horrific case. And there was an incredible amount of publicity about it. And so during that trial, I actually had threats to my family and got phone calls. And so SLED, South Carolina law enforcement, sent people to my house. My kids were escorted to school every day in police cars. And there was somebody stationed outside of our house during that trial.
Jeez.
It took a couple of weeks. And that was probably in 85 or 86, I think. And it was a very notorious case. And that was the one time that I really had a lot of fear about, somebody that I was representing. And the public many people that I knew understood why I was representing him. And that's my job. Mm-hmm. Plus I knew his brother from law school. We were friends. So I represented him. But there are people in the public who just don't understand that kind of thing. And so we did get threats, and they threatened my children. You know, how would you like this to happen to your kids?
Wasn't the guy you were defending or his buddies. It was just people in the community who thought he shouldn't have a defense that were threatening you.
It was general people in the
That's
community.
That's crazy to me.
People that I had no idea who they were. And there were, several threats, but the problem was the threats were against my kids. My kids were, at that age, they were maybe 10 or 12 years old. And the trial lasted 3 weeks, and I was out of town for the trial. And so we had to have police protection. And I think they even actually wired my phone, to capture, the phone numbers of anybody who called. So it was, pretty hairy for a while.
No kidding.
Pretty concerning.
Well, the Charlotte Observer titled you Mr. Murder. What do you make of that title?
Well, that was John Monk, who's one of the great.
Oh, was it Monk?
Oh, Monk.
I didn't know
it was Monk.
Yeah. I'll have to talk
to you. Yeah. Well, John, the Pee-wee trial was the first trial that John covered in South Carolina. And so we became friendly because we were in court together, for 8 weeks. And I love John. I talk to him to this day, actually. We're very, very friendly. But then he also covered the Bell trial, and he wanted to write this feature article for the Charlotte Observer, and it was a front page Sunday edition where they call him Mr. Murder or something like that. And my mother was very proud of me, obviously. but it was kind of a moniker that stuck. And so to this day, there are still people that call me Mr. Murder because of the number of murder cases that I've handled over my 50 years. This is my 50th year. And so I've handled many of those, and then I've handled several very high profile murder cases as well.
Something about the guy who came from the place where The Sopranos was being called Mr. Murder.
and 50 years in, any thoughts of retirement, or you're going to keep on going?
No, I'm not tired. I think I still have all my mental faculties. Physically, I feel fine, and you know, it gives me the juice to get up every morning and go to the office and, you know, work. I think I outwork any young lawyer around. I don't mind.
That's my dad. My dad is 50 years in, and he's still going too, and he has no signs of retiring.
Isn't that great? I mean, it's wonderful. And I still, when I get in the courtroom, I get exhilarated. The adrenaline starts going. And so I have no thoughts of stopping.
Good. And I'd love to have you back to talk about forensic psychiatry and to talk about some of the other cases. And because I also, and we've said this on this podcast many, many times, we don't think it's fair how like sometimes Griffin and Harpootlian are ripped, not because of things that are, I think should be on the board to criticize them about, but just simply because they're defense attorneys. And I don't really understand that line of attack. And I think it's great that you've done what you've done through your life.
Yeah, thank you. I'm proud of what I do. I represent some horrific people, but I also represent some really great people who have made a mistake. And, college kids, bankers, lawyers, doctors, but for a few seconds in their life, making a bad decision. And that doesn't mean they're all guilty either. I mean, I've had, a number of acquittals. There's something to go in and fight for. It just, like I said, it's a big adrenaline rush when you're in there in the courtroom and you're defending somebody. Particularly when you know that person is not guilty. I don't let up at all, even if the person's guilty, because I believe in that the state has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't do anything unethical. It's all by the book. I've never been accused of doing anything that I shouldn't do. I think I have to bring everything that I have into the courtroom and defend somebody and do it honorably and ethically. And I believe I serve a service to the public.
Heck yeah.
By requiring the state to come forward and prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm not looking for a pat on the back. That's not what I do it for. But I do it because I believe in the system.
Well said. And Jack, hopefully you'll come back on with us. Really appreciate it. And thanks for spending some time with us.
Sure. Give me a call anytime. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I cannot wait to have him back on. So interesting.
Yes, I want to hear more about or do a whole episode on this Larry Jean Bell story.
Do you remember that at the time?
No, I don't really. Vaguely.
Vaguely.
So I need to research this more.
Great, great. We will have to for sure. We have an episode that we'll be re-releasing, which has more on Pee-wee Gaskins. So look for that. Upcoming, we interviewed the man behind a podcast about Pee-wee called All in the Family. He was also doing a documentary, so look for that coming soon. All right, Ms. Seaton, where do they find us?
You can find us on Facebook at Impact of Influence.
And any ideas that you have of cases you may want us to follow or learn about or interview someone about, let us know. And of course, we're still doing all the Murdoch stuff. Do not be worried about that. We'll be on top of it for you.
Story that keeps on going.
That's right. So we're always grateful. Please rate and subscribe and share. And we'll talk soon, friend. Hello, friend. Last episode, you heard us talking to Pee-wee Gaskin's defense attorney. So here's a flashback episode where we talked about Pee-wee Gaskin's a few months ago. Enjoy.
Thanks again for listening. We really appreciate it. And reaching out, you can find us on Facebook, which is Impact of Influence. We will talk soon.
Friend.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident? That's up to you and the law to decide.
But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation.
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.